You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 11th of March 2024 on Monocle Radio.
China's annual Congress issues its annual statement that everything is fine. Pope Francis radically reduces his consignment of Christmas cards from Ukraine. And could the key to electoral success in Tasmania be a new habitat for Oompa Loompas? I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. My guests Nina Dos Santos and Ivor Gaber will discuss the day's big stories, and we'll hear from Peter Pomerantsev about his new book, which recalls an earlier European information war and introduces the remarkable character who won it. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on the Monocle Daily. This is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and I am joined today by Nina Dos Santos, international broadcast correspondent, former CNN Europe editor, and by Ivor Gaber, professor of political journalism at the University of Sussex. Hello to you both.
Hello.
Hi.
Ivor, you, first of all, or as we should now address you, Ivor OBE, have been to Windsor Castle to collect your gong.
Yes, it was for somebody who I have to confess is not a dyed-in-the-wool monarchist.
This is how they get you.
To all my friends. It was a surprisingly good occasion. They're very well. It looks very formal, but they're incredibly friendly and they're so organised, and you just smooth your way through. And the only downside is the amazing price they charge for the photographs afterwards.
That's a decent racket they've got going there, then,
yeah,
isn't it?
And I was slightly surprised when the blurb you get about what to expect. There will be no tea. There'll be nothing to eat or drink for the 3 hours you're there. You're not allowed to take your own photographs. But here we have a couple of companies that are willing to help. But apart from that, let me just say, finally, I was presented with my OBE, and it was for media freedom, not for journalism, by Princess Anne, who was actually who was very well informed. And we had a good chat. And in fact, I was obviously so loquacious that eventually the princess's equerry tugged her arm and say, you know, next, please. But it was a good occasion. And my daughter, I have three daughters. They were delighted.
Well, congratulations again. Nina, you have not, to the best of my knowledge at least, had any post-nominals conferred upon you by royalty recently. But you
not yet at all.
But you have been to Bucharest, which is nearly as good.
Ah, well, that was with the political royalty in the ascendant there. The
centre, nice segue.
The centre-right parties of Europe that are actually at the moment, interestingly enough, enjoying their time in the sunlight, even if, of course, they're getting challenged by the far right. And we'll get a chance to talk about that later on in the show with the results of the Portuguese election. But yeah, no, I was moderating the big get-together of the European People's Party, which is the centre-right bloc, as they came together to announce their manifesto and announced that their candidate for the European Commission president for the second term is going to be Ursula von der Leyen, the former German defence minister. It was a really interesting event because, as I was saying before, you can see how the political map in Europe is being redrawn. We've got the European parliamentary elections coming up in 3 months' time, and this was their time to try and rejig away from things like the big green New Deal that von der Leyen announced at the start of her first term and move towards issues that the electorate is feeling more keenly, like migration and also defence.
Well, we will start the show proper in China, and the annual two sessions conclave of the National People's Congress and the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference has ended with a demonstration of resolute unity, as opposed, yes, to all those other years when it concludes with robust knockabout ideological argument and rowdy factional brawling in a spectacle evocative of the closing scenes of Blazing Saddles. As usual, there appears broad agreement vis-à-vis the ongoing sagacity of the vision of President Xi Jinping. Although of the 3,000 or so members of the Congress, 8 rugged free thinkers did vote against a law which directs China's cabinet to do as Xi tells it. Nina, to ask this question really is to answer it, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Did we learn anything much from this annual Bino of the Chinese Communist Party?
Not really. And I think what we also learnt, if anything, was that there's even less room for dissent, because what's interesting is that normally there's a press conference afterwards, tightly controlled, as you can imagine. But this year it appears as though there wasn't one. I'm sure, Ivy, you'd like to say something about press freedom in China, given the state it's in at the moment.
But there's lots of it, they tell me.
But there was no room for journalists to ask questions. And this is the only once-in-a-year opportunity for journalists, normally at least, to ask some tightly scripted questions on a rather innocuous subject, such as the economy. You know, we're not talking about human rights and so on and so forth that are really thorny issues. We're talking about the economy, but obviously, you know, the economic statistics supposedly match up with China's targets, but increasingly outside of China, nobody really believes whether or not those targets are really being met. And then the other thing I'd say is that, you know, this was also an opportunity potentially to shore up some concerns about, you know, the defence minister having been fired, the foreign minister having been replaced quite quickly, you know, members of the business community in China are being purged, sporting champions are disappearing. None of those questions and concerns were assuaged at all by this spectacle.
Well, either because of those concerns and because, I mean, I guess it's not a happy indicator, as Nina points out. There's usually a press conference of sorts given by the Premier. At the moment, Li Qiang, they've been doing that every year for 30 years, and this year there isn't one. But is there a sense, do you think, that Western countries in particular, who have underpinned China's economic surge, are now starting to look at all those factors that Nina enumerated and think, I don't think this place is going to improve. The corner is not going to be turned. Foreign direct investment in China is down to a 30-year low.
Yeah, I do think it's related to the press conference. Embarrassed would be the wrong word when you control the media so greatly. But perhaps she didn't want to, even with tame journalists, go on about what a great success the Chinese economy was, is. And I think it's possibly significant. Certainly, all the indicators are, well, not all the indicators, but the Chinese economy has lost its oomph, and we need that oomph, actually. The global economy needs that oomph. So it's not necessarily good news in terms of the economic outlook. Politically, yeah, Xi has never been so strong. I was struck by reading a couple of reports how they keep, and this is relatively new, certainly in the last few years, re-emphasising the Marxist-Leninism. I mean, you do have to go to some sort of intellectual gymnastics to equate the harsh capitalist system they have. How does that bear any relationship to Marxist-Leninism? Or they also quote the thoughts of Chairman Mao, who I don't think was a great advocate for capitalism. So I do think economically, they're in a mess is too strong a word, but it ain't going great. But also in terms of the narrative that they're giving their people, I'm not sure how coherent it is.
I mean, Nina, how contagious would be a significant economic downturn in China? Is the world not taking steps to insulate itself from China? I mean, and even the fact that so many companies are now spending less in China than they were, or deciding to do their business that they were doing in China somewhere slightly less opaque.
Yeah. Either by default or by design or just by circumstance. If you look at, for instance, as I was talking about before, the centre-right parties in Europe, they came out with their manifesto, which specifically pointed at China and took a far more hawkish stance. And that's significant because obviously, you know, Germany is the big economic powerhouse, or was up until recently, of the European Union, and used to sell a lot of cars to China. In fact, bent over backwards, irrespective of human rights concerns in places like Xinjiang province, they still continued to do that because it was so crucial to the German manufacturing industry. I think they're starting to pivot away and realise that they have to. You were talking before about the Marxism and Leninism and Mao Zedong thought pattern. To give it its proper name, it's socialism with Chinese characteristics for a new era, apparently, as Xi Jinping calls it.
It slips off the tongue.
And I think that speaks to how difficult it is for Western governments to second guess exactly what Xi Jinping's stewardship of the economy in China is going to lead to. And if it doesn't lead to a good outcome, the question now is also, will he be tempted to embark upon military adventurism with regards to Taiwan? Because what's also significant is over the last week, you noticed that the language changed on Taiwan. It changed to no longer the peaceful reunification of Taiwan, but just the reunification of Taiwan, which also possibly is a hint at trouble to come at the time when we've got the UK elections and the United States elections later on this year.
Well, sticking with the subject of military adventurism somewhat, it is probably generally understood that if you're Pope, being officially in favour of peace kind of goes with the gig. However, as Pope Francis may have absorbed this past weekend, there is a time and a place and a way to speak up in favour of beating swords into ploughshares and other such broadly similar invocations from the Book of Isaiah. Chapter 2, verses 3 and 4. That's how meticulously researched the Monocle Daily is. Francis suggested that Ukraine should, as he put it, find the courage to hoist the white flag and negotiate with Russia. Ukraine's response via President Volodymyr Zelensky and Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba has been somewhat brisk. Ivor, does Pope Francis have a quoted out of context get out here, or was he saying what it very much sounded like? Was he saying what it very much sounded like he was saying?
I think it's the latter. He looks at the suffering and says, goodness, this has got to end. I was going to say something which, well, I will say and then contradict myself. All wars, of course, have to end in negotiation. They don't, actually.
No, they don't.
The Second World War ended in absolute victory for the Allied powers. So the argument people have said, oh, well, Zelensky is going to have to negotiate at a certain point, is not necessarily the case. They could just opt for defeat or even victory. But one understands the Pope's, what's his word, the constituency is not solidly behind Ukraine. And it's not, as we know, much of the global south and China, India, although not too many professing Catholics in those two countries. See,
there's
Russia's
not many
point
in
of
Ukraine
view.
Either, come to that. It's about 10% Catholic Ukraine.
Right, that's true.
Give or take.
But, he is an activist pope. And I think he has, on other issues, felt obliged to comment. I think he could have phrased it better.
But, Nina, what struck me, and this is a commonality among activists who take an interest in various conflicts, he seems only to think that one side in this conflict has any agency at all. He did not say, for example, that the way for the suffering to end is for Russia to pack up and push off back home over the other side of its own borders.
And this isn't the first time, let's face it, that he's sort of, as Ukraine might say, run roughshod over history and over you know, wading into the battle of right and wrong in war. In fact, the Ukrainians rebuffed very swiftly with their foreign minister saying, look, don't talk to us, lecture us about the white flag. Our only flag is our flag, which is blue and yellow, and it's going to stay that way. I think the point Ivor makes about the global south is really astute here. I do think that also There are various factions, aren't there, among the Catholic Church, Pope Francis being a Franciscan, a Jesuit has an important point of view, which is slightly different from other sort of Benedictine factions inside the Vatican, who might be quite irked at him entering the debate here on this, particularly because, remember, Pope John Paul II was so important back in the day at the time of the Cold
Indeed
War detente.
He was.
And he came from Poland and he was very much a championing pope of, you know, trying to triumph over Soviet ideology. And so obviously, for obvious reasons, you've seen a lot of those type of voices enter the fray here and saying, well, look, Pope Francis, yet again, he's overstepped the mark politically and he's going to find himself on the wrong side of history, they say.
And what did you make of the Ukrainian response, though, Ivor, as a journalism professional? Nina quoted part of Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba's response about saying, our flag is a yellow and blue one. This is the flag by which we live, die and prevail. We shall never raise any other flags. But he accompanied that, I thought, rather cutely with a reminder that there is a standing invitation to Pope Francis to visit Kyiv whenever he likes.
Yeah, I mean, firstly, you would expect the Ukrainian response to be robust. I mean, they cannot give an inch. I think that was quite a smart move because the chances of the Pope visiting Kyiv or anywhere else in Ukraine, I guess, are pretty remote. Although this Pope is not totally predictable.
They're re-establishing flights, aren't they, soon?
They are. It may be. I mean, if the President of the United States can get the train to Kyiv, I don't really see why the Pope can't.
As you say, Bo, he's only got 10% of Catholics in the country. There's not a great deal in it for him. But, you know, I mean, never say never. And with this, as I say, I think Francis is an interesting pope. And it's this, maybe, given the rebuff he's had from Ukraine, he might feel that this is a grand gesture. But I think he's got more to lose than to gain.
Just finally on this, Nina, and if we're thinking about why this may have been a somewhat ill-judged intervention, it is arguably quite a dangerous thing to say. If you consider the Ukraine scepticism to which you alluded, which is now at large in parts of Europe, but in quite a lot of the United States, and whether or not one thinks it is right or reasonable that anyone does pay attention to what the Pope says, people do.
Oh, absolutely, they do. There's over a billion Catholics around the world, and they absolutely do. And as I've always saying before, the captive part of that audience is in places like the Global South, Latin America. This is where his constituency is growing. That's the other thing we have to remember as well. Catholic populations that are committed, that are having children, whereas here in Western Europe, there's a decline of people who practice, and there's also a decline of people who are having children as well. And in the United States, you're right, it's an argument that's probably going to gain quite a bit of traction. I think it's a very politicised statement for this Pope to make. But obviously, we're entering into the time running up to Easter. And I suppose the point he's making is he believes that for citizens who are affected by these wars, whether it's in Gaza or Ukraine, he's trying to send out that message of peace, but rather badly worded, I think.
Yeah, well, I'm just going to pick up Nina's point, because I think the use of that phrase, the white flag, is so redolent of surrender, as opposed to, he could have said, it's time for more talking or whatever.
Or for peace to prevail.
Or peace to prevail, yeah. But white flag is a very red flag to a bull. Have I got that right?
I think the metaphor sort of holds just about. But we will look now at another European Catholic country, this one being Portugal, which voted in a general election yesterday. As was widely predicted, the biggest winner was the far-right party, Chega, but they weren't the actual winners. To the extent that anybody was, it was the centre-right Democratic Alliance coalition, who fell a distance short of a majority in the Assembly of the Republic, but they seem to think they can form a government nevertheless, according to their leader, Luís Montenegro, shortly to become a pub quiz answer as the only European head of government whose surname is the name of another European country. If there are exceptions to that rule, please don't write
Hang
in
on,
and tell
and,
me.
And a
I
drink,
haven't been
I
able
think,
to check
I
all
think
of them.
I think there's an alcoholic liquor called Montenegro as
very,
well.
Very probably. Anyway, if so, this will mean a change of government for Portugal. The previously ruling socialists had a lousy night, losing 43 of the 120 seats they hitherto held. Nina, first of all, and you have just been, as we were saying at the top of the show, in Bucharest, discussing this and other related matters, I'm sure, with the finest centre-right political minds in Europe. Does this tell us anything if a far-right party makes these kind of inroads in Portugal, which is generally held to be a fairly mild, equable sort of polity? But they won 18% of the vote, which is a fairly big leap on where they were. Do we glean anything from that?
Oh, I think this speaks volumes about the political trend that the landscape in Europe is going to be rocked by this year. By the way, remember, it's not just European countries that are going to the polls over the next few months. We've also got hundreds of millions of European Union citizens who are going to be able to vote in the European parliamentary elections in the month of June. And there's real concern among the centre-right parties that, yes, they're facing a bit of a paradox at the moment. They are the most powerful parties collectively across much of Europe. But on the other hand, they're actually having to face a resurgent far right that they're very, very uncomfortable about engaging with. And I think what's happened in Portugal is an example of that. What it speaks to is that electorates around much of Europe feel that the traditional centre-left and centre-right parties haven't been able to answer their concerns on a few things. One, demographic change and the fraying of the social contract between young and old generations, falling standards of living that have gone on for now 10, 15 years, and also that issue of migration. Migration is crucial in Portugal because it's a country where there's traditionally been a big problem with brain drains. So it's getting older, and as a result, it has to import more migrants to keep the economy going, keep the population vibrant. And in fact, just 6 years ago, there were 500,000 migrants arriving. Now it's 1 million. So you can really see why this has given this party an in here.
It does present Chega's likely role as kingmaker, that is, Ivor. It does present the milder parties with the dilemma of do you do business with these people in order to corral the majority. Montenegro has said he won't make a deal with Chega. It remains to be seen whether that resolve holds if it's his only path to government. But is that a sensible thing for what we think of as the establishment parties to do when confronting insurgent populists? If you lock them out of government, doesn't that just amplifies their narrative, doesn't it? It's just like, we are being frozen out by the establishment, go us.
Well, I suppose there's a wink-wink, nudge-nudge kingmaker role they can have. The DUP, the Protestant party in this country, sustained Mrs. Thatcher in power. Without
Mrs. May.
Blimey. Mrs. May in power. Not spotted, deliberate error.
It was a test and I passed.
Sustained Mrs. May in power without being part of the government. And it's possible for particularly centre-right parties to have an accommodation with far-right parties without formalising anything. Obviously more difficult in the extreme for centre-left parties to do that. Whether they... I don't know enough about Chega, although I like the name enough. whether they'd be content to sit on their hands and watch, if their thesis is the two main parties have failed, they might want to sit there and watch, because there's the balance of power is not obvious, although the centre-right... At the moment, there's more, still four seats waiting for the overseas votes to come. But the centre-left, if they formed an alliance with the communists and the left bloc, they would have a majority over the centre-right, but not an overall majority. Whether Chega wants to play it long and watch the two parties tear each other to pieces and then go to the electorate and say, look, there's no alternative.
I mean, there may well be another election sooner rather than later. But just finally on this one, Nina, did this topic come up at this wingding you attended in Bucharest about whether you should engage, do deals with, govern with the far-right parties? It's not an easy decision to make. And we are seeing, I guess, the apex of that in the Netherlands right now, where the far right under Geert Wilders actually won the election, but there still isn't a government because everybody is being quite squeamish about being seen to get into bed with them.
Well, I think the German-speaking political leaders across the EU are extremely vocal about this because of the challenge from the Alternative für Deutschland, the AfD party in Germany, but also I think it was... Nehammer, the Austrian Chancellor as well, alluded to this, saying, look, you know, the far right, we're going to call it out, is a real concern for political leaders like us. And under their breath, if you speak to various EU officials from these parties, the first thing they'll do is blame Emmanuel Macron for having torpedoed the centre ground. It was just amazing how few French voices you heard among any of the centre-right leaders who got up to speak. I think just one deputy made a tiny procedural intervention in French. The only person who actually spoke French at the time was Antonio Tajani, the Italian foreign secretary, drifted into French in one of his speeches. And the real concern for the centre-right here is the rewriting of the electoral map by Emmanuel Macron has left France potentially as the weakest country in Europe for potentially having an official right-wing government after 2027 when Macron can't run again. So it's really in the forefront of their minds, and in the back of their minds, their fear is that all these parties will start to do their own deals with each other and then start to exert leverage in Brussels.
Can I, in fact, forgive me, take it, just ask Nina, do we see the first signs of it in this country? Today, a Tory MP has joined the anti-European party.
Anti-everything, party reform.
Has been taking significant share of the votes, according to the opinion polls, from the Tories. I just wonder, because we haven't had a far-right party making significant inroads to the British electorate so far, but this could be the start of it following that European trend.
I think the difference, obviously, is that our political system works differently. But having said that, the crucial thing that you're alluding to there is obviously Lee Anderson, the former deputy chairman of the Conservative Party, now having had the whip removed, been kicked out of his party for seemingly Islamophobic comments, now he's defected to Reform. It's the big sort of political scalp that this Faragist, Nigel Farage's anti-Brexit, anti-everything, as you pointed out, party has managed to claim. The question is whether other Tory MPs defect with him. What they probably, presumably, really want is to rewrite the rules in the UK Parliament to get proportional representation, which would obviously give them a much bigger say, which is the type of situation that we're sort of seeing in some European countries. So, yes, I mean, I think you're seeing parts of it protected by the UK system, prevented by the UK system at the moment. But if they do gain more traction to get more leverage and get that system changed, this could be what could come.
Well, it is not knowable whether or not Portugal's socialists might have survived to govern another term if they had promised their voters an enormous chocolate fountain, but at least one incumbent office holder believes such a project to be a winner. Specifically, the Premier of Tasmania, Jeremy Rockliffe, has committed $12 million Australian towards the creation of a chocolate experience, it says here, alongside the Cadbury factory in the settlement of Claremont. It will include an assortment of chocolate-themed attractions, including a chocolate fountain, which will seize the title of the world's largest such gusher from Austrian confectioners Confiserie Wenschitz. The Tasmanian election is on March 23rd. I'm sure you both knew that anyway. Big red circle in your diaries. Premier Rockliffe is polling OK, Ivor. Do you think this will seal the deal?
Oh, I wish I could think of a good pun to answer that one.
A bad one will do.
OK, I mean, I don't know the Tasmanian electorate well enough to know whether
this... Honestly, how can you not know the Tasmanian electorate?
I confess my knowledge of global politics just stops at the Australian mainland.
I'd like any Tasmanian listeners to address their complaints personally to Ivor Gaber and not Monocle Radio as an entity.
Ignoring your heckle... Do gimmick the bigger question, the slightly serious question is, do gimmicks work? Mm. And in general, if you look across the piece, the answer is they don't. One thinks of, having said that, the gimmick works if it reinforces a political message. Mm. You know, Mrs. Thatcher, and I do mean Mrs. Thatcher in a tank, you know, the strong woman standing up for Britain, was one gimmick that worked, but because it reinforced an existing message. But what message is this reinforcing? That we're a chocolate nation? I mean, I don't really get it.
The Cadbury's factory in Claremont is, in fact, the Southern Hemisphere's largest chocolate factory. That is a fact I confess I did not know when I woke up this morning. Nina, would you, though, on balance, all things being equal, actually cross the street to see a chocolate fountain?
Probably once. And then probably never again. I did notice, by the way, that the member of the government who's quoted in this Guardian article talking about it is called Simon Current.
There you go. Okay, fine.
There's quite a few food puns. I mean, I'm just surprised that, you know, we've had so many years of wrangling over sugar taxes and unhealthy food taxes in this part of the world. I'm just surprised that everybody's celebrating, chocolate at vast expense.
Channeling his inner Wonka, I quite liked.
Yeah, I mean, you'd want to pronounce that carefully.
Well, there was Rishi Sunak who said we underestimate the intelligence of the British public because I don't know how they know that my favourite film was Willy Wonka, but everywhere I go, they shout Wonka at me.
Indeed. So have either of you, in closing, ever been tempted, I will ask you first, either by any sort of confectionery-related museum or attraction? Have you, for example, ever been to M&M's World right here on London's famous Leicester Square?
I confess not. I have a passion for chocolate. I think most is...
I'm very much in favour of it.
But I can't translate that into going to a museum of chocolate or any sweets for say. But there is a children's amusement park, which I'm trying to think what it's called, is based on No, I've got it wrong. It's Legoland. Forgive me.
Just you can't eat Lego
either. I just want to, again, making clear from Monocle Radio, we do not endorse eating Lego. It's an extremely bad idea. Again, if any of your children, as a consequence of this broadcast, have eaten any Lego, please take it up directly with Ivor Gaber. Nina, are you a regular season ticket holder at M&M's World?
I confess, I've been to M&M's World a few times. I've got an 8-year-old and a 6-year-old. They love it.
Can you please answer a fundamental question which I have never dared seek the answer for to myself? What the hell is actually in M&M's World? I am genuinely agog.
Lots of different coloured sweets that you could buy in a newsagent for 20p a packet
more,
or something.
It must be more than that. You can't have a whole exhibition.
Well, it's opposite, I think, the Lego shop as well. So, you know, you and I could visit together for one time.
I think we all know where we're going right after this show. Nina Dos Santos and Ivor Gaber, thank you for joining us. Finally, on today's Daily, with disinformation and misinformation, as with everything else, it is much easier to fret about the problem than advance a solution. In this specific instance, however, a prescription may have been written during World War II by a German-born and raised British journalist of Australian parentage. Sefton Delmer, for it is he, is the subject of a new book by Peter Pomerantsev entitled How to Win an Information War, The Propagandist Who Outwitted Hitler. I spoke to Peter earlier and began by asking him to introduce his book's extraordinary protagonist.
Sefton Delmer, during World War II, launched one of the most surreal, successful, amoral, and simultaneously deeply inspiring projects to undermine Nazi propaganda. He became sort of head of special operations for covert propaganda against the Germans. But essentially, he created sort of at some point dozens of radio stations that were like a cabaret. They pretended to be Nazi stations, which were simultaneously subverting the Nazis. He had a whole cast of people, and I say cabaret for a reason, because a lot of them were from the Berlin cabaret scene, who were playing, and again, a lot of them were Jewish, who were playing sort of swearing Nazi soldiers who were furious at their commanders. He actually had a real priest who was sort of like, you know, raining fire and brimstone down on the Nazi leadership. And actually, he was running stations in many languages. There were Italian stations, Bulgarian stations, Romanian stations, French stations. The biggest stations were transmitted live, almost like the BBC. And they were as popular as the BBC, even though they were pirate stations, essentially. They were transmitted live with music and a big band and a cast of many, many characters, a lot of them German POWs, essentially doing this sort of German armed forces station. But again, there were speeches from Goebbels on it. They'd learn to hack into Nazi radio and retransmit Nazi content. And in between, they do this really subversive stuff, these sort of, you know, stories from the front lines about how awful the food was or how awful the weapons were. And here's the really interesting twist. And the moment I decided to write a book about this. Because let's be clear, the Nazis were doing something very similar to Britain. I'm not talking about Lord Haw-Haw here. Just to be very clear, the Nazis actually had a bunch of really unsuccessful stations that pretended to be British. There was like a Cockney station called the Workers' Challenge, where a couple of Cockneys would go, you know, Churchill's being run by the Yids. We've got to rise up and stop Churchill. And then there was like a Scottish independence station called Radio Caledonia, which would say Scotland's got to leave this war and seek peace with Germany. All pretending to be local stations, but they were really pants and people just laughed at them, actually. But what Delmer did was much cleverer for two reasons. Firstly, German audiences were meant to be in on the game. So that he wasn't trying to deceive audiences. What he was doing, and he describes this in a lot of detail, was giving people a safe way to express their resentments against the Nazis, both technically. So if your commander walked in, you go, well, I thought this was a Nazi station, sir. It appears to be saying, sir, that you're very corrupt. But I thought it was just a Nazi. I mean, look, it's got Goebbels speech on it. But even more importantly, psychologically. And everybody who worked on this writes about this. So it was fascinating going through the archives and the memoirs. And I found some memoirs that were lost to time in my research. And it's incredible how sophisticated they were. They were like, people need to play a game where it's not the BBC screaming at them that Germany's bad. It's got to be their own people saying it, even if they know perfectly well it's the British who are behind it.
I mean, to read the book is to become both baffled and frankly mildly outraged that Sefton Delmer is not a household name, that he hasn't been on postage stamps, banknotes, the subject of a 15-part Netflix drama, which hopefully may be extrapolated from your book, because it is an amazing story. But parallel to that in your book, you kind of write a manual of propaganda and how it has evolved and how it might be applied perhaps to our present circumstances. And obviously you've written a lot before about Russian disinformation and Russian propaganda. Is there somewhere in Sefton Delmer's techniques some way that the West might now usefully fight back against Russia's current misinformation?
Sefton Delmer he's like a trickster god. You know, he does all these naughty, crazy things. And like all trickster gods, some of it's very negative. He does some really dark things. He talks about it himself in his memoirs. He does some really amoral things. I'm not saying we should cut and paste what he did and do it today. Yeah? I'm saying there are negative lessons we can learn from him, and there are positive ones. What is true, though, is that he and the people who worked with him, and the people who worked with him were Cambridge University's first professor of psychiatry. Mm-hmm. Ian Fleming, Muriel Spark, incredible academics, German surrealist artists, classicists and economists and psychologists. And what they were on a mission to do, because it was the war, because it was existential, was to really work out how do you reach people? How do you reach people under the sway of a murderous propaganda, which is frankly very attractive?
What Delmer
said is like, forget about preaching to people about democracy. Forget about the whole like, you guys, you Germans, think about liberal values. He said, it's gone. We should have done that in the 20s. We missed that. We are now talking about people who are living in an alternative reality. How do we reach them? How do we break their connection to the leadership and so on and so forth? So the questions they were setting themselves are the ones we need to answer. What he thought was pointless was he didn't like the BBC German service very much. Because he felt it was preaching to the converted. So he would look at a lot of our liberal media today that's just preaching to the converted and not reaching audiences in MAGA land or under the sway of Russian propaganda and say, this is pointless. If you're not getting to those audiences, you're not doing your job.
Is there then, I mean, there's an obvious parallel, I should say, between then and now in that most of Europe finds itself up against an adversary, many of whose citizens do live in a parallel reality dictated by their regime's own propaganda. Just as Sefton Delmer had the advantage of having grown up in Germany, for all that he was actually an Australian / Briton, you have the advantage in this respect of having been born and raised early on, at least in what was then the Soviet Union. You do write early on in the book that you saw certain parallels between yourself and Delmer, but if we absorb his lessons and that there's no good in preaching to people, if we do have an interest in trying to reach the people of modern Russia, is there anything in Delmer's career that might help with that?
Oh, completely. So firstly, we have to stop hoping for some sort of like romantic democratic uprising. I mean, the killing of Alexei Navalny the other day and the lack of big reaction within Russia shows you really where we are. Resistance, if it ever was there, has been broken. Delmer had a very unromantic view of human nature. He thought people enjoyed negative propaganda. He thought it was up to you not to preach to them or win them over, but to essentially help destroy the other side's propaganda machine. To get people, he wasn't trying to like get people to be good. He wanted them to be disloyal to the Nazis. Yeah, it's a very different aim. It's not about finding the good. It's not about being idealistic. It's about getting them to not follow orders. And you get them to not follow orders, whether it's civilians or soldiers, by finding things they care about even more than their belonging to the group created by the Kremlin or the Nazis. He was deeply unromantic in that sense. He was he was like, we've got to find what people care about even more. He talked about looking for people's inner pig dog, which was basically meant the stuff they care about, survival, economic self-interest, or something else. Also maybe family ties, religious ties that are stronger than their bond. And to get through that, get them to act in ways that was disadvantageous to their leadership. So let's say today, well, this is all very abstract, I know. Let's say today, right now, there are Russian soldiers stationed in Syria, Crimea, all along the southern flank. The other day, there was a leak, or a hack, I assume, that was published on a Ukrainian website about how those soldiers' leaders spread fake good news about how well the war is going and don't tell the truth about what's going on. I would like tomorrow for these soldiers to wake up and there to be a radio station. By the way, radio is actually still quite a good medium, but let's say a multimedia project that allows them to, in safety, tune into a non-stop, emotionally visceral, very, very bawdy and funny stream of news that would embarrass their leadership, that would give them the motivation and self-confidence to start defecting, surrendering, and disobeying orders. Yeah. Del Mysterio is that people want to do that. You've got to find psychological ways to give them the courage to do that in a way. And that would send the leadership absolutely nuts, thinking, oh my God, where are these leaks coming from?
That was Peter Pomerantsev speaking to me earlier about his tremendous new book, How to Win an Information War, The Propagandist Who Outwitted Hitler. Very much recommended. That is all for this edition of The Monocle Daily. Thanks to our panellists today, Nina Dos Santos and Ivor Gaber. Today's show was produced by Tom Webb, researched by George Ruskin, and our sound engineer was Tamsin Howard. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily returns at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening.